Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Welcome to Murder Mile. Today, I'm standing outside of BBC TV Centre in Wood Lane, W12. A tube stop south of the Wormwood Scrubs massacre. Two streets east of where Reg Christie euthanised his dog. A short walk from Lena Cunningham's drowning. And a little dawdle from the Shepherd's Bush sadist. Coming soon to Murder Mile. Opened in 1960, Television Centre was an all-purpose self-contained television studio, complete with a scenery dock, editing suites, a costumier's, as well as an office where I pretended to work, a basement in which I mostly snoozed, a bar in which I spent a decade getting seriously shit-faced, and all of the staff's favourite person, Manny the Tea Lady.
Thank you, darling.
It's a place infamous for making some of the world's most iconic television shows, like Doctor Who, Blue Peter, Steptoe and Son, Fawlty Towers, Quatermass, Blackadder, Monty Python and Top of the Pops. But sadly, it's more synonymous as a place which shielded sex pests, rapists and paedophiles. As well as, quite possibly Britain's most pathetic excuse for a wannabe serial killer. In 2001, 55-year-old douchebag Brian Darby was convicted of hatching a sad little plan to slaughter six women across West London in a murder spree to rival his so-called hero, Jack the Ripper. As what this friendless little twat wanted most was fame. Ugh, so tragic. But lacking any skills, any talent, and with a statistically small penis and the brain power to match, this useless little turd unleashed nothing but pain and pity. My name is Michael. I'm your tour guide. And this is Murder Mile. Episode 246. Jack the Shitter. In the pantheon of serial killers, you probably haven't heard of Brian Darby. And for good reason. Born in Leicester in 1946, as another unwanted side effect of too many amorous parents who bonked to mark the end of the Second World War, Brian Peter Darby should have gone on to live an ordinary life as an unremarkable man in the 32nd worst place to live in Britain. And in many ways, he did. Almost nothing is recorded about his upbringing. He achieved a basic education. There were no known reports of sexual abuse. And he was raised by his mother as a good, God-fearing Protestant Christian who regularly attended church and supported the work of the Salvation Army. As a young boy with dark curly hair, gerbil-like eyes, and an increasingly gormless face, even into his 50s, he still retained a childlike quality, which endeared him to others who saw him as no threat. And although he wasn't tall, strong, or powerfully built, often coming across as a bit of a loser, it's easy to suggest that he may have been bullied, but who wasn't? So what drove him to want to become a serial killer? From his teens to his early 20s, he drifted between jobs, as most people do, as he tried to work out who he was, what he was about, and what to do with his life, given the fact that he had no skills or talent. Living in Greenswood, which was then a pleasant little road sprinkled with a hodgepodge of bungalows, farm buildings, and ramshackle sheds in the remote and leafy village of East Goscott in Leicestershire, he was surrounded by fields, woods, and even a railway society. But what it lacked was excitement. In 1972, with a fascination for crime, a desire to be respected, and to earn a good living as the local bobby, Brian attended Hendon Police College on a 13-week course, and he graduated as a probationary constable. Unlike the other young whippersnappers who were just fresh out of school, Brian was already 26. But being baby-faced, he barely looked 16 when he began his shift as a beat officer in the city. The 1970s was a bad time to be a copper, as Britain was in chaos. With mass unemployment, strikes, power cuts, race riots, a recession, skyrocketing inflation, and an enforced three-day working week. Therefore, crime was rife, the bins weren't being collected, and the streets stunk of shit, piss, and festering nappies. In Leicestershire, Gartree Prison erupted into riots. Imperial typewriters went on strike. And 24-year-old prostitute Rosina Hilliard, also known as Rosie, was found beside a building site on Spinney Hill Road with extensive head injuries and fractures to her collarbone and spine. Later discovered to have been strangled, she's suspected of being one of the first victims of Peter Sutcliffe, the Yorkshire Ripper.
So the Ripper has kept his chilling promise and struck again.
As a beat copper, he may have been called in to cordon off the street or secure the scene before the detectives arrived on many horrific crimes which ravaged the county and kindled his morbid love of all things grisly. Or maybe he saw nothing, as his days could have easily have been spent cooing cats out of trees, stopping drunks from whittling, or if he was lucky, collaring a bag snatcher or a knicker sniffer. Across his 7 years as a constable, it gave him a sense of power, control, and the respect that comes with a uniform and a badge. But being just a humble bobby, with his duties being as far from the thrills and spells of kicking down doors, roughing up hoodlums, speeding a Ford Capri down the back streets at 50 miles an hour, and maybe being flashed a set of boobies, as seen in the TV series The Sweeney, he'd developed a fascination for true crime. It's a common pastime which the uninitiated may regard as unhealthy. But it only is when the audience loses their grip on reality, forgets that real lives are involved, and sidelines the victim's tragedy in place of praising the skills or pitying the past of a pathetic loser's desperate search for fame and attention. Sadly, Brian was the latter. A dull little Herbert who mistakenly thought that he was unique and even remotely interesting because he had a poster of a serial killer on his wall and could reel off a pointless list of who killed who using what, simply because he'd wasted half of his life sitting on his fat lazy arse, watching cheaply made shite on the telly and trawling through a dirge of ill-informed true crime toss. But it was that that ignited his desire to be famous. As a child, he'd been enthralled by Jack the Ripper. The infamous and possibly fictional case of the East London so-called serial killer, who, when you conveniently cherry-picked the scant details, was either a genius or a maniac who, being blessed by his fans with godlike skills, charmed every victim to their deaths, and through his cunning, supposedly outwitted a perfunctory police force at every turn. Yawn. As a teenager, he'd have digested the endless tabloid diatribe about the sadistic child murderers Myra Hindley and Ian Brady, whose heinous crimes elevated these two sad and tragic tossers to the height of a celebrity, making them icons of the 60s. And even though they had murdered children, as if to twist the knife into their grieving mother's broken hearts even further, they've been immortalized by their fans. And as a bored and frustrated police constable who plodded his beat in Leicester, at every turn across the mid to late 1970s, he'd have seen the sycophantic wall-to-wall coverage of the Yorkshire Ripper as this tragically pathetic little arse candle, with no skills, no talent, no charm, no personality, and with not a single redeemable feature, dominated the British headlines for years, having achieved nothing. In Peter Sutcliffe, he saw himself. In Jack the Ripper, he saw his mission. And yet, if he was Ian Brady, what he was missing was his Myra Hindley. Born in 1958 in the West Country suburb of Westbury-on-Trim in the city of Bristol, Jeanette White was only 14 years old when 26-year-old Brian Darby met her, and some say groomed her. As a vulnerable girl who should have been protected, across the 28 years they spent in their on-and-off relationship, by her 40s, as an alcoholic, Jeanette was drinking 11 litres of strong cider a day, or so she claimed. Referred to by Brian in a series of sexually explicit and deeply disturbing letters written between the two of them as My Myra Hindley. In the later years, Brian would try and groom his long-term lover or possible confidant, Jeanette, to pick out the most vulnerable of victims for an orgy of lust and death. Given his warped mind, it's amazing he wasn't caught sooner. But across the 7 years he spent in the Leicestershire Police Force, Constable Brian Darby was said by Superintendent Norwell to be a reliable, straightforward, and efficient officer who would have had a good future in the force. And he would have done, had this pathetic little loser not had a perverted weakness. Children. As a well-known, but not particularly well-liked constable, in early June 1979, knowing that his gormless, gerbil-eyed face was too familiar in Leicester, always committing his attacks in neighbourhoods where he was unknown, he travelled 40 miles to Birmingham and a playground in Selly Park. Dressed in civvies, Brian Darby, then aged 34, saw a 5-year-old boy sitting alone by the swings. Sidling up beside him, Brian chatted to the defenseless and isolated child. He spoke to him about his favourite toys. He pulled out a bag of sweeties from his pocket. And then, seeing that the boy's distracted parent was smoking a cigarette, several times he forced himself on the youngster, kissing him full on the lips. Hearing the child's screams, the other children ran off to tell the boy's father, and having darted across the park, diving over the roundabout and through the swings to lamp this dirty little fucker squarely in the face. Although Brian fled with blood spurting from his busted nose, just one street away, he was arrested. On the 22nd of June 1979, at Birmingham Crown Court, Brian Darby was tried for indecently assaulting a five-year-old boy. And in a bafflingly short-sighted twist, Judge Ross described this predator's behavior as an aberration, stating,
"Perhaps the best thing to happen to you, to bring you to your senses, was the punch the boy's father gave you."
A psychiatric assessment was made, but failed to prove to the authorities that he was a danger to the public, and that, owing to the stresses of a demanding job and a home life, it was brushed off as a blip. Kicked out of the police force, before any further embarrassment could be reported, as well as any other crimes against children which he may have committed, having served a short sentence in the prison's nonce wing, he moved in with his girlfriend Jeanette in Bristol, who'd taken back this convicted paedophile. From the summer of 1979 to the mid-1980s, being 2 decades before both CRB checks and the sex offenders register were introduced, once again, he drifted between a smattering of mindless manual jobs in factories and warehouses, which didn't require him to reveal his conviction. And again, he lived an ordinary and unremarkable life as a security guard, as over the decade, he married Jeanette twice. In the late 1980s, with their relationship in a fragmentary state, although Jeanette often lived in Bristol, they also assumed the identity of a happily married couple living in Lavender Hill in North London. Being Christians, they belonged to the Enfield chapter of the Salvation Army, shaking collection tins in the faces of annoyed shoppers to ironically raise money for the most vulnerable, as behind them, an out-of-tune brass band blasted out festive carols. None of their fellow worshippers knew anything about Brian's past. But deep down, his thoughts of a murderous killing spree were forming. In the early 1980s, having masked his conviction for kiddie fiddling, Brian got a job as a fire and safety officer at BBC Television Centre. Core, you're probably thinking. I bet he did cool things like rigging the gunshot which killed Dirty Den in EastEnders, or fill in the gunge tanks on Noel's house party, right? No. Brian was one of those boring little men in high-vis vests who stalked the long corridors of TV Centre with a clipboard, checking that all of the doors were shut, refilling the fire buckets with sand, and reprimanding any staff members who flicked their ciggy buds into a plant pot.
Is that an ashtray? I think not.
But like when he was a constable, as a security officer, who will have overseen the public's access to shows like Jim Will Fix It and Top of the Pops, 2 hugely popular shows for teens and children, which was presented by some of Britain's vilest sex pests and paedophiles, the job itself gave him access to people. Watching the productions also gave him an insight into how TV shows are made, as seeing all the girls, boys and their mums being quizzed by the researchers and ushered into studios by assistants, like willing participants who would do anything for their 5 minutes of fame. He also saw that this kind of person was trusted. On the long boring nights spent endlessly walking the same dull corridors, he fantasized about stalking, raping, terrorizing, and slaughtering a slew of terrified women across London in a vicious spree so horrifying. It would make him as internationally famous as his blood-soaked hero, Jack the Ripper. At night, he dreamed of the fame which awaited him. The book signings, the adoring fans, maybe even being invited to a crappy, overpriced crime convention, and the endless cheaply made documentaries which would hail him as a crafty, charming master manipulator with a genius IQ, a foot-long cock, and hair which didn't resemble pubes. All the while, imagining the grisly nickname that the tabloids would give him. Maybe the West London lobotomizer, the Acton annihilator, or the Shepherd's Bush slaughterer. But in truth, it wouldn't happen. As a more apt title for this gormless twat and gerbil-like tosser would have been Britain's most pathetic loser, the turd who stalked London. Or as I shall call him, Jack the Shitter. In 1998, as his girlfriend Jeanette had moved back to Bristol, in an endless stream of perverted verse to the woman he described as my Myra Hindley, in more than 150 letters, over 400 plus pages, Brian wrote about his deep carnal desire to rape, kill, dismember, and cannibalize his victims. As having become obsessed with necrophilia, he dreamed of raping a woman as he killed her. In his letters, Brian wrote,
"One day soon, we must both kill a girl and we'll be together forever. I need the body of a female to sacrifice and to use her death as our birth. Any race, creed or colour, any female of any age is fair game. Once the sin of murder has been embraced, the age becomes a mere detail."
And in a hint to his sick and twisted paedophilia,
"A little angel is as welcome in my bed as a page 3 girl. I will take whatever you bring me."
And describing the death as
erotic torture.
Even though he had asked her to destroy all of his letters, in an odd and twisted homage, they were later found in her home, bound in a leather binder. By the turn of the new millennium, Brian had begun planning his killing spree. The hunt for victims was simple. Unlike his hero, Brian wouldn't stalk the fog-wreathed streets of London, wearing a cloak, a top hat, and dashing into doorways, letting out an evil laugh. Nope. He used Loot, one of the UK's leading free classified ad papers, which, in an almost pre-internet world, was a great place to sell cars, clothes, unwanted crap, and as many people did, their homes. And being a physical newspaper, it had to include the seller's name, location, and a phone number. With Jeanette having found each victim, to assess their suitability, Brian called them up.
"Hi, I'm Brian. I'm a researcher with the BBC. We're doing an investigation into flat sales and finding tenants. And I saw that you're selling your flat in Loot, and I wondered if I could have a few minutes of your time."
And of course, always wanting to be helpful, each woman was happy to answer his very standard questions, such as,
"Are you married? Do you live alone? When would be a good time to come and see you?"
Questions a TV researcher would ask. And having sent Jeanette to each home to recce the property in advance, Brian, the wannabe serial killer, had begun to prepare his kit. Packed in a rucksack,
he stashed what he called his murder and rape kit, containing an A to Z map, a pack of condoms, a garrote made of curtain wire, a set of gloves, a dictaphone to record his victim's dying moments, and as the perfect piece of his disguise, his official BBC identity card, which only contained his name, a matching photo, and the recognisable BBC logo. But with no department nor job title, he could have been anyone. In total, he stalked 6 women. And each time, he failed. Of the 2 attacks we know about, on the 4th of October 2000, at the agreed time, Brian knocked on the door of the Westminster flat of Susan Ogra, a childminder and mother of 2 in her 40s. Having opened the door, Susan let in this softly spoken, sweet-faced man who held his identity badge up to her eyes. And although he knew that she possibly had a tenant, as he'd already seen her advert in Loot, realising that her well-built Polish lodger was sat in the living room, like a coward, Brian made his excuses and fled. As a truly pathetic excuse for a man, let alone a wannabe serial killer, Brian only attacked the most vulnerable of victims, women and children who were alone. And having already failed 5 times, his 6th victim was chosen with more care. On the 31st of October 2000, Halloween, this rodent-faced tit slunk his way along Windermere Road in Ealing to supposedly interview an unnamed 45-year-old mother of 4 who at that time of the day was alone in the house with no lodgers, all of her children at school, and her husband away.
Hi, it's Brian from the BBC. We spoke on the phone.
Oh, hi, come in. Can I get you a tea?
Oh, that would be lovely. Thank you very much.
And so began the standard pleasantries. For about an hour, he chatted about her home, her life and her house sale, recording it on his dictaphone and stating that
if we use you in the documentary, we'll pay you £250.
Which for anyone is always a nice little bonus. With the interview having gone well, and asking,
do you mind if I look around and take a few photographs for the director?
Having built up a trust with him, she had no qualms about walking him from room to room. But as they approached the kitchen, it was then that he struck. Wrapping the white plastic curtain wire around her neck. As she struggled, he squeezed harder. But as a woman who'd given birth 4 times, who knew what pain was, and who in her own words would say, I wanted to be alive for the sake of my children. With his grip loosening, she pleaded with him, if you don't kill me, I'll give you anything. Money, sex, anything. In his eyes, it was the magic words. A victim who was willing to do anything to please him. And like an idiot, he believed her. And he let go. But as he turned his back on the crying woman lying at his feet, she kicked him hard, ran out of the street, and as she said, screaming like a crazy woman, and again, being a tragic little cesspit of piss, through the back garden, Brian fled. As Britain's most pathetic loser had failed for a 6th time. Brian Darby was suggested as a suspect
in the unsolved murders of Elizabeth Chow and Lola Shikoya. Crimes which media-hungry whores like Levi Belfield routinely claim responsibility for. And although the detective who arrested Brian described him as one of the most dangerous men ever arrested and a serial killer in the making, surely it's wrong to give this loser the glory that he so badly craved. In a short but swift investigation, just 6 weeks after the Ealing attack, detectives traced the call to a phone at the BBC, as well as his fingerprints on a cup of tea, which had been held on the police database since his conviction for assaulting a child. And identifying Brian, who had used his real name and his real identity card. When he was arrested at work, it won't surprise you to learn that he was facing disciplinary action for downloading sickening photographs. Tried at the Old Bailey on the 21st of December 2001, with Mr. Justice Fogg recognizing that his girlfriend was under his spell and worshipped him. You were also a willing and an enthusiastic supporter of Darby and all of his vile plans. 43-year-old Jeanette White of Bristol was sentenced to 7 years in prison for conspiracy to murder. Found guilty and deemed a risk to the public, 55-year-old Brian Darby was given two sentences for attempted murder and conspiracy to murder, with a further 7 years for aggravated burglary. As of today, age 79, if he is still alive, and let's hope that he isn't, Brian Darby, the wannabe serial killer, is stuck inside a prison cell, dreaming that true crime fans are hailing him as a criminal mastermind. When in fact, he was just a twat. So instead of singing the praises of this gerbil-faced turd, rather than giving him fame, if he is to be remembered, let's make sure it's as a pointless little turd known as Jack the Shitter.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
There we go, folks. Oh, my Lord. Oh, I didn't know whether I was going to record that today. It's pissing down outside. It's on and off pissing down. You know when you look at the weather report and they go, oh, it's torrential all day. And then you look at it and go, well, it's not. And then you decide to start recording. I take your little hat off. There we go. And then suddenly they go, oh, no, it's raining now. So it was raining when I was recording that. And now, nothing. Not a jot. Not a diddly squat. Oh. Time for yawn. So I hope you enjoyed that episode. That was one of those ones that I wasn't planning to do. But ages ago, I was putting forward an idea to someone about a project, and I stumbled across this
an article on this, and to be honest, there's not much out there. This is one of those cases that almost doesn't exist. You've really got to search for it, and there's bits and pieces, but there's not much. So I basically pieced together what I could. It's not based on any police files or court records because they're not available. But I just thought it was one of those interesting cases about someone who's just, you know, a sad little pathetic little loser who loves true crime and is just like, oh, I'm going to be a big successful Jack the Ripper type. Oh, and then he just fails massively. And I thought, what a good way to do it is just to make sure that he doesn't get any kind of respect. Because that's the worst thing, isn't it? It's like with some of these assholes that are out there. Too often in true crime, people go, oh, he was brilliant. Oh, he had all this cunning skill. He outwitted the police. Oh, and you just go, no, he didn't. It's like a lot of the time it's just mistakes. A lot of the times, you know, the police can't be everywhere. They're like, oh, yes, no, he escaped from the police. It's not like the police were sitting outside his house and then he dodged past them. The police were off doing other jobs, you know, and then. I just find it really baffling that people do like to praise these kind of assholes. But when you look at it, half the time they're just lucky. Half the time, no one's really looking out, thinking, oh, there's going to be a serial killer walking down this street. Half the time, I mean, that's a lot of halves there. Half the time, you know, these kind of people blend into society because they are pathetic little people, just used as people who haven't achieved much. Therefore, no one really thinks that they're going to turn out to be these assholes. Most of the time, these one-off murderers are the kind of people who end up in prison straight away because they're angry all the time. Whereas the reason these kind of people can kind of blend through society is people think nothing of them. But I think what's different about him is because he is quite a pathetic little loser, a jerk-off, a nothing, a wank stain. I know the police are on there and they were saying, oh, he's one of the most dangerous men arrested. But think about it. It's like, who does that really serve? Does that really serve us or does that really serve the detective? Because does the detective really want everyone to know, oh, you arrested a guy who's a jerk-off who out of six women that he stalked, he basically wrapped a little bit of cord around one woman's neck and then he let her go. Do you know, he's all talk, he's all mouth and no trousers, he's all talk. In all these letters, he talks about all the great things he's going to do and he achieves nothing. So actually for the detective, it's kind of great to go, oh, I arrested a serial killer in the making. But it's like, did you really? Or he said, does that just big you up really? So, and that's the same with the press as well, do you know. This is why I think this case didn't really go anywhere, because it's not really that exciting when you look at it all in context, and it's kind of this little jerk off. He doesn't achieve anything. He's a bit pathetic. He's a bit pointless. You know, it's quite sad. So yeah, and that's probably why it hasn't really got out there. So, but I think it was quite good that with the conviction itself, unlike the first offence where he was caught kissing the little boy. You know, assaulting a five-year-old boy, you'd think he'd get a good amount of time in prison, but he didn't. I think part of it was because he was a policeman. So therefore, it was like, oh, you know, no prior criminal convictions. He's a good bloke. As the judge said, oh, it's an aberration, meaning, he was clearly drunk. Something must have gone wrong in his life. Let's hope it doesn't happen again. But clearly, the judge on this case went through all the letters that were stored away and looked at all that and looked at what type of person he was and thought, do you know what, he could be a real liability. So let's lock him away for a long time. And they did. He got two life sentences for attempted murder. So that's interesting, given the fact that quite often when we've covered cases on here and someone has committed an actual murder, an actual premeditated murder, and they get a couple of years in prison, whereas this time, this guy was like, you know, they put him away for two life sentences plus 7 years for aggravated burglary. So two life sentences, so that will be, there will probably be life sentences to be concurrent. So he's probably 20 years on that and then 7 years on top. So even if I think he's still probably in prison. I did do some searching, but I couldn't find him anywhere. Problem is he's got, you know, Brian Darby. Brian. You're quite a kind of common name as well. So, yeah, I searched. I couldn't find a death record, so he's probably still alive. Could still be in prison. Still a tosser, though, isn't he? Still an absolute wank stain on society.
Oh, did I say welcome to Extra Mile, the unscripted, unedited bit? I don't think I did. I should really have done. So there we go. There we go. What else is happening here? I'm not going to make a cup of tea, only because I'm going to go to a coffee shop in a bit. Having a nice swig of water, though. Oh, fresh, refreshing water. Lovely. A thank you to Hannah Olsen and Francois Cabrel. I hope I pronounced your names correctly. With the last episode, I had a little bit of a problem trying to work out how to pronounce a Norwegian name. It was the ski instructor who was in there, and I couldn't work out. It was like Drnulf or T, I think it was. I couldn't work out how to pronounce it, and they kind of pointed out that it could be the Norwegian O with the line through it that no one uses anywhere else, and therefore, because this was kind of it had been typed on a British machine, it looks like they'd. The detective had used a D in place of it because we hadn't got anything on there. So that was great. That really helped. Even though it was unimportant to the episode, I like to get things right. I like to kind of get names and details right. So, yeah. Otherwise, I would have called him Doomph. Doomph. So there we go. Thank you to new Patreon supporters. Thank you to Barry George. I hope that's not the Barry George. Lena James and someone called TFI. So thank you to Barry. Thank you, Lena. And thank you, TFI. What else is going on? Following on from next week's episode, which we got... last week's episode, which was the one where I'd put one of my many freedom of information requests where I put out for cases to be released and then I can reinvestigate them. There's another one of the same era that hasn't been released yet, and it's I'm really hoping that this is another unsolved one, another unsolved prostitute in around the same area in and around 1942. So there's no real reason why they shouldn't release it, but I've just had one of my many emails from them saying, oh, we're still looking in this, but we'll let you know. So I'm hoping that one gets released, because that could be that one I'm really excited about, but we shall see. Anyway, let's do some quiz questions. And then we'll try and dive into as much stuff as we can that's extra into this. But there's not a lot, to be honest. I put almost everything in the episode. So let's do some quiz questions. Question number one. What year was BBC Television Centre opened? I know when it was shut. It was shut in 2013 because I was there. I was there in the bar having fun. And I was there when everyone was running around the building fleecing it of all the signage. Literally, you've never seen so many people going through the whole of the BBC, stealing stuff, and security just staring at everyone going, I don't know what to do. question number two, in which city was Brian born?
Oh, Brian.
Question number three, what was Brian's middle name? Question number four, what religion was Brian? Question number five, what was the name he lived on when he was a child? Question number six, where did he do his training as a copper? Come on, Police Constable Arsenal Guinness should be able to get this one. Question number seven, what age was he when he became a police constable? Question number eight, where was Jeanette born? Question number nine, how much older was Brian when he met 14-year-old Jeanette?
Pedo.
And question number 10, how many years to the nearest five were they together? So I will... a little note to myself to record some next... Unulf Hoop. That's what I'm going to add into the next one. Was Private Unulf Hoop.
Fairly big week.
So let's. I haven't got much to dive into. Normally with this one, normally I have to cherry pick all the details that I can give you an extra one. I don't have a hell of a lot. I literally have put almost everything in there. So I went searching and I found kind of the details about the attack on the 5-year-old boy. It said a constable in the Leicestershire Police was passing through an unnamed children's playground. I managed to work out it was in and near Selly Park. While on a visit to Birmingham, so that means he wasn't in uniform, the boy was sitting down.
He kissed him several times. The other children ran off to tell the boy's father, who came to the scene and hit Darby in the face. Darby then ran off. It was said he was approached the boy in a Birmingham playground and began kissing him on the lips. He was arrested not too far away. 23rd of June 1979, he was found guilty in Birmingham Crown Court of indecently assaulting a boy aged 5. He pleaded not guilty. He was remanded on bail while reports were made, and he was sentenced on the 17th of July. He was fined £200, having been found guilty by a majority verdict of assaulting the boy. In other articles, it says he served a minor sentence, but that minor sentence also could be the fact that he was remanded. So quite often what will happen is because it was, how long was it? It was a couple of days, yeah. Yeah, it was just a couple, no, it was about a month. So 22nd of June until the 17th of July, so almost a month. So given the fact that he'd spent a month in prison awaiting the trial, it's likely that the judge, being quite lenient on him, had probably said, I'm going to sentence you to a month in prison. Oh, that's convenient. You've already done a month. Okay, in that case, I'm just going to charge you £200. So that's a bit shit, to be honest. A bit shit. The judge said there was no rational explanation for Darby's behaviour, and I feel justified in dealing with this matter on the basis that it was some kind of aberration. Judge Ross said perhaps the best thing that could have happened to you in order to bring you to your senses was the punch on the nose your father the boy's father gave you. In some papers it says that Darby was sacked from the police force. In others it says that he voluntarily resigned. In some of them they also get the year wrong as well. They say it's 1978, not it's 79. It is suggested that he was being investigated by the police at that time for indecently assaulting other boys. But I couldn't find any more about that. That seems to be kind of everything that's in there. Although there were, as we see in here, even though he's based in... Oh, I can't remember if that's a quiz question. Even though he's based in a certain city, he travels over to Birmingham because he makes sure that he commits his crimes never in the neighbourhoods or the areas where he's known, so he's always travelling. But in and around the same time the Birmingham Post said the police are hunting a crazed sex maniac in Birmingham after sadistic attacks on little girls. As we've seen, he attacks young boys, he attacks young girls. Detectives fear that the prowler who lurks around children's playgrounds may already have struck a dozen times. The latest attack happened near Pershore Road in Selly Park, where a 4-year-old girl was out in the sunshine with a 7-year-old boy. They were stopped by a man who gave them 15p and told the boy to go away. He then seriously sexually assaulted the girl. She was badly shocked but not hurt, and later gave a detailed description of the attacker. Interesting. It's a description that it doesn't fully fit Brian, but let's not forget that the girl is 4 years old. So, you know, trying to get information. If you go back to the Soho Strangler case, don't forget we got 5 people who stood next to a murderer, talking to him for about half an hour, and they thought his age ranged from late 20s until early 50s, and you know. So she said she thought he was 18 or 19. So that means a lot older than her. So it could have been 20s. Said he enjoyed playing football with the boys in the area. He was about 5'8" tall. We don't know what height Brian was, but that's about right. Black, greasy hair. Yep. Bushy eyebrows. Yep. Blue jeans, red shirt, black trainers. That's all she could really report on that. There were also similar other incidents in the Sturchley area, which is not too far from there as well. The relationship between Brian and Jeanette is kind of a weird one. She seems to be spending a lot of time in her hometown, but also living with him as well. They seem to be on and off all the time. They seem to have been married twice. They seem to separate quite a lot, but they seem to stay in touch. So I've tried to be a bit cautious with this one, because even though she was charged with conspiracy to murder, and there's a lot of weird stuff that's going on. Like, she's keeping the letters. She
seems to love him, but there's the whole thing about him picking her up when she was 14 years old. We don't really know a lot about her back history, so maybe she's being groomed, or maybe, you know, maybe she's as messed up as he is. So we just don't know. So I've kind of played a bit easy with that. Not easy, but kind of cautious with that one, because we don't really know about her background. As mentioned, they were in the Salvation Army in the Enfield chapter. Interestingly, if you look at the Salvation Army, founded in 1865 as the East London Christian Mission by one-time Methodist preacher William Booth and his wife Catherine, it can trace its origins to the Blind Beggar Tavern, which is oddly where Ronnie Crane murdered George Cornell. Not that we've ever covered that on the case, because I just can't be arsed with that. And also, it's East London as well, so who cares? Who cares what happens in East London? Interestingly, he got a job at the BBC in the 1980s. That's kind of interesting, isn't it? Given the fact that this is all around the era of Jimmy Savile, Stuart Hall, Rolf Harris, Jonathan King, and later arseholes like Max Clifford. All paedophiles and perverts. Well, there we go. So yeah, he was just one of many paedophiles and perverts that were being protected. I think, given the fact that his job when he was there, because he was a security guard, this is the years before CRB checks, which is Criminal Records Bureau checks. That's where they check your criminal record. Being before he would have been put on the sex offenders register. So given the fact that with his job, if you were a researcher on Jim Will Fix It, you would have had your background checked because you're dealing with children. But because he's just a guy who stands outside going, this way, okay, stop there. Oh, why is that window open? No, close the window. Put that cigarette out. You know, they don't really need his kind of criminal record on that. So, you know, in that kind of era, I remember being interviewed in around that era, and it was like, if you had a criminal record, legally you had to mention it. But if you didn't mention it at the time, you'd go, oh, sorry, I made a mistake. Do you know, unless it's really, really important. Not saying that I did that, because I've never had a criminal record. You're welcome. Unlike Eva, I'm not even going to go into. Jesus Christ. Let's just be honest. Most of it's drunk and disorderly and criminal damage and shitting in the street as well. She loves doing that. Loves doing that when she's had a big kebab. As mentioned, quite a sad little man who wanted to emulate his hero, Jack the Ripper. He became obsessed with the idea of having sex with dead bodies. I mean, he loved bragging about shit all the effing time. But what did he achieve? Nothing. What have we got? The letters. We've only got fragments of the letters. I've kind of used pretty much most of what we got in here. We have his letters to her, but we don't have her letters to him, which kind of unbalances the case slightly. So even with the case, like, it was said that she was the one who went through loot and found all of these people, and sometimes she would call them up, but also she went, according to the new, this is all coming from newspapers, so how much of this we can trust, we don't know, but according to the newspapers, it is said that she visited the victims to assess them in advance before he went to visit them. And because we don't have his letters that he wrote to her, her letters that she wrote to him, because he was saying, oh no, destroy everything, so he destroyed all of her letters, but she didn't destroy his letters, therefore kind of all of the onus is kind of on him. So it's described by this judge as unbelievably disgusting, letters containing extreme sexual fantasies involving the most revolting sexual perversion, including having sex with a woman while killing her. As mentioned, more than 150 letters, anywhere between 380 and 450 pages, references to cannibalism. Let's see. In the letters, Darby tells White, that's his girlfriend, it is only after we have killed that we will be truly joined. He described their victim as his wedding present to her, saying, one day soon we must both kill a girl together and we will be together forever.
I need a body of a female to sacrifice and to use her death, which will be our birth. Any race, creed or colour, no lower limit. Any female of any age is fair game. Doesn't seem to like boys anymore. He says, once the sin of murder has been embraced, the age will become a mere detail. A little angel is as welcome in my bed as a page three girl. If you're not from Britain, back in the, I think it stopped in the 2000s, but on the Sun, glorious tabloid newspaper, which is always full of facts, always full of lots of facts and never lies. On page three, they'd always have a semi-naked lady with her tits out. And then a little article next to it says, Susan, 26, 34 double D, thinks, and then her opinion about politics or something that she knows fuck all about. Because that's how they like to treat their readers, like shit. Although for the Sun, apparently the Sun is aimed at people with a learning age of 7. So there you go. I'm not going to say what the learning age of people who read the Daily Mail is, but there we go. It says he encouraged White, his girlfriend, to find a victim, telling her, "I will take whatever you bring me," and he fantasized about erotic torture. So that was the way that she found the victims, by going through loot, as mentioned. The ladies she found were looking to sell their flats. He would ring them, claiming to be a BBC researcher. Back in those days, I mean, who's going to say you're not? And it was really as simple as that. Quite simple. But then again, it was all cocked up because him being a complete arsehole always ballsed everything up. We don't know about the first six. Of the six women who he stalked, we don't know about the first four. And also, we don't know what order these other ones go in. We know that the one with Susan was at the start of the month, on, I think it was 4th of October, and the other one was on Halloween. We know that. But the other four, we don't know anything about. They weren't reported on. So there we go. I think I'll do the quiz questions. Yeah, I'll do the quiz questions now. And then I'm going to go off and get a cup of quaffy. So here we go. Question number one. What year was BBC TV Centre opened? That was 1960. Question number two. In which city was Brian born in? It was Leicester. 32nd most worst place to live in Great Britain. Question number three, what was his middle name? It was Peter. Question number four, what religion was he? Supposedly, he was a Protestant Christian. Question number five, what was the name of the street he lived on as a child? It was Greensward. Question number six, where did he do his training as a copper? That was at Hendon Police College, which apparently is a good pub nearby, according to Police Constable Arsenal Guinness. And of course he would know that. Question number seven, what age was he when he became a constable? He was 26. Question number eight, where was Jeanette born? Bristol. Question number nine, how much older was Brian when he met 14-year-old Jeanette? Well, he was 26, therefore that's 12 years. Pedo. Of course, if you're a rock star and you're in your 40s and you happen to be dating a girl under 16, that's fine, isn't it? That's all acceptable. But anyone else, pedo. And question number 10, how many years to the nearest five were they together? They were together 28 years. So if you say anywhere between 23 and 32, two is that? I don't know. Oh, who cares? Who gives a shit? It's just shite, isn't it? I mean, you're not going to win anything. You're not going to get a prize for answering shitty questions. Oh, so there we go. Oh, I'm hungry now. I haven't even got any lunch available. Oh, man. And there we go. It's still not raining. Still not raining. It only rained during that midsection when I was recording that. But that's good. I've got some other stuff to record. So that's it, folks. Have yourself a good week. Thank you for listening to Murder Mile. I'm not too sure what episode I'm doing next week. It will be a one-parter. So I hope you enjoy that.
Time for yours.
Time for beddy buys, me think. So have a good one. Stay safe and be good. Lots of love. Bye.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.